Avi Adoni Dodi. We enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Gal einai va'abita niflaot me'Torah-techa. Shalom. How's everybody? Hope all is well. Does anybody have anything they want to say or ask before we drop into it? Great. Okay. So we're working through kind of more a deeper exploration of the five primary tectonic shifts that were instigated through the eating of the tree, through Adam and Chava's eating of the tree of knowledge, the paradigm shifts that changed the entirety of creation and the entirety of reality, and now are comprised the, as I say, brave new world that we are rebuilding and enjoying and also repairing. So there are five primary shifts of this sort, and we are I think on number three, but anyway, I'm going to summarize them all. So the first one is the appearance, the introduction of Klipat Noga, that the tree of knowledge of good and evil that is really describing this state of affairs called Klipat Noga, where there are the extreme polarities of good and evil, like holy and forbidden, and a whole continuum of shades of gray in between them that is called Klipat Noga, meaning that it's available, it's divrei reshut, it's comprises things that we are able to partake of and work with, but we have to make the decision of, is that really, which of all the options before us is really the high road? The Klipat Noga includes most of these options, and we have to, but it's possible that in our partaking of them, that we will bring damage to ourselves, or we'll bring a fall or a desensitizing to spiritual truths, because it isn't really fitting for us to travel that route, to make that choice in this particular moment. So it's along with one of the primary consequences or features of this layer of reality, or this feature of reality called Klipat Noga, is that it invites us to make decisions at every moment. And it also requires us to refine our decision-making process, so that, and we're going to talk quite a bit about that later on in the class, because we are, when we get to number five of these five features of our brave new world. So the first one is the appearance of Klipat Noga, and along with all the decisions and uncertainties that it brings. The second is, we talked about how in Gan Eden, this is kind of a chidush of the Leshem as far as I can tell, that in Gan Eden there was a, I mean, this fact is from the Ari, but the implications that he makes of it are his chidushim, I think. So the structure of reality at that time, of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden time, there was a moat what the Lesham describes as a moat of 10 sphirot wide that separated the Gan Eden, the holy Gan Eden, from the Klipot, from the still fallen sparks connected to Adam and Chava's soul that Hashem didn't raise and repair when in the six creation days. He left these sparks still fallen and assigned them to Abraham, to Adam and Sarah as their life's work to kind of raise these sparks and integrate them into Kedusha. And so that in the as a consequence of their eating from the tree of knowledge, so the lights above fell down, pulled, came down a few notches, and the shadow realms from the Klipot below rose a few notches. And so that 10 Klipot moat now became filled with these lights and shadows, and ultimately, where that moat lines up in terms of our reality now, it is basically includes the emotional plane. And so that is to say then that as a consequence of Adam and Chava's eating from the tree of knowledge, so reality reshuffled, reorganized itself, and this emotional plane appeared in the universe. And presumably, it appeared because it is also bringing with it tools and resources to negotiate the Klipat Noga that we just spoke about, that is such a challenging task before us to navigate our way through that Klipat Noga in the most good-serving, God-serving, and spiritually productive way possible. And so the one of the tools that we received also in this shattering of reality was this emotional plane and that whole level of information that we can use to help refine and clarify the choices that we are making on a daily basis as we engage with the Klipat Noga. The third shift that happened, that was caused as a result of the eating from the tree of knowledge, is that not only is there an emotional plane kind of existing in the world, there's a world of Asiya, the physical plane, Yetzirah, the emotional plane, the newly appeared emotional plane, Bria, the mental plane, and then the Chaya and Yechida, which are the Makif levels of soul that hover and are not really yet integrated into our identity, into our personality. So our personality basically comprises the Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. And the Ruach, we're getting into this third shift, the Ruach is really as the middle layer between the neshama, which is the mental plane and the higher lights, and that is more in touch with the nefesh Elokit, which is the divine soul, and the ruach is below that, and above the nefesh and the more somatic level of our larger soul, which is includes the which is the vital soul that is kind of more engaged with creature comforts and survival instinct and health and things like that. So it is the and so the that inner ruach, which is also it's the enochiut, it becomes the ego basically that is the that assumes the role of selfhood or identity or I center or ego, whatever you want to call it, and integrates the mind and the body. That's really what, as we talked about a lot, that's what emotions are. They are a mental interpretation of reality. This is Hasidic understanding of psychology. I'm sure there are other interpretations of it, but this is how the Tanya talks about it, which is that emotions don't come spontaneously on their own. They're always a response to some interpretation of reality. So that's the mental plane input. And that interpretation of reality then produces a physiological response that our somatic and autonomic systems start activating or triggering or shutting down or whatever. And each emotion has a set of features that identifies it as this emotion as opposed to that. And the ruach is the one that then experiences the emotion, processes it, and decides where to go with that. So that's the another presumably tool that came in along with the shift in reality of the Klipat Noga and all the confusion it brought. So the this inner ego and ruach is kind of helping us to find our way, something that we draw upon to find our way. The fourth shift is that Hashem placed a revolving, spinning, fiery sword at the entrance to Gan Eden to block our entry, our return, and yet our messianic era requires our return into Gan Eden, which means that we have to somehow find our way through this fiery revolving sword. And it's kind of set up as this check and balance that how do we know, how does Hashem know when it's time to let us through, that we have completed the tikkunim that are that were required of us, and we've really reached our, accessed our, attained our tzidkut, our tzaddikness, in what to whatever extent it was expected of us, and so how so now it's time to go to return to Gan Eden and then go from there to the post-Edenic levels of eternal bliss is how it's described in the Leshem. And so it's set up that how does we know? Well, if you can get through the fiery sword, then you're worthy of being inside Gan Eden. And if you can't get through it, then it's back to the drawing board, and you have to, there's more inner work to be done in order to be able to find our way through. And that brings us to the essential ingredient that we need to cultivate in order to get through this flaming revolving sword. And that is Ruach HaKodesh. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is that we have to, let's see, I just want to read this, that we need to, as we talked about, this fiery revolving sword is also a, it's not, I mean, it's not exactly really a sword. It's just life and all the challenges that life brings. It's like a flaming revolving sword, and we have to be on our toes, and we have to kind of hear the message of the moment and the and then the message of the next moment, which could be completely different. Like, it's really requires a full kind of presence and wisdom and also a rectified nerve net that has been honed through the our life challenges and also our Gilgulim. So in order to get through this sword, meaning in order to really succeed in life to the level that we must in order to enter to begin our messianic and post-messianic phase of growth through joy. We need to internalize the lessons of life to such a degree that our instinctive and reflexive response to the moment is always and only in line with spiritual law. Not because we consulted the codes before responding, but because we've absorbed into our nerve net the principles underlying the codes. We no longer need to think about what to do, because we instinctively know what to do, and that knowing is reliable. We can only cross the finish line if we are truly wrapped in Ruach HaKodesh. So I want to talk a little bit about that then. So then now I'm dropping into the book, which is on page 132. The commentators marvel at how Esther of the Purim story managed to pass through all the layers of security, preventing intruders from entering the king's throne room uninvited. It's as though Esther's royal gown became an invisible cloak that allowed her to slip past the guards straight to the inner chamber, sight unseen. In fact, the Talmud teaches, Vatil Bash Esther Malchut, that Pshat is the Esther enwrapped herself, like clothed herself in royalty. Malchut is a word term that means royalty, and that's one way of interpreting that verse, that phrase. But Malchut also is the 10th sphera of the Eitz Chaim, of the tree of life, and it is the sphere of the Shechina, of the lower Shechina, and associates with Ruach HaKodesh. So another interpretation of this verse, Vatilbash Esther Malchut, is, as the sages interpret it, that Esther was enwrapped in Ruach HaKodesh. Guided by divine inspiration, Esther dodged the king's security detail, i.e. his metaphoric revolving sword, and entered the inner chamber unscathed. In her death-defying mission, Esther had nothing to rely upon except her channel of Ruach HaKodesh. At each step, she scanned the horizon for options, waiting for her heart to whisper yes. And there she would move. An extended fast. Is today the day? This hallway instead of that? A wine party for three? Another? There was no neon signs or prophetic voices, not even a battle plan. Alone with her instincts, Esther had to hear Hashem's holy word speaking through them as surely as he spoke at Sinai. I just want to add that that people, I don't know, might know or might not know that the Matan Torah of the Torah Sheba'al Peh is Purim. That just like Moshe brought down the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, he was the channel for that transmission. So Esther was the channel for the transmission of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. That is the, what do I want to say about that? Wait, what was it? Hold on. Right. That there's a confusion in the at Matan Torah when the Torah is describing the Israelites gathered at the foot of the mountain. There it says that Moshe kind of gave us a preview of the Torah, what the Torah would be like, the Torah up until that point, whatever had been recorded of it up until that point. And we said, Naseh v'nishma. We said, you know, it's okay, Moshe, you don't have to tell us all that right now. We trust you, we trust it, and we're in. And we'll learn about it later. And so it was like with whole heart we accepted the gift of the Torah without reservation. That's one reading of it. But the Midrash also says brings that that Hashem that we resisted the Torah and Hashem had to hold a mountain over our head and force us to coerce us to accept the Torah. So what's right and how do those two fit together, those two interpretations? And so the Rav Tzadok talks about this a lot, and he talks about how that the we accepted the Torah Shebichtav wholeheartedly. The Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, is actually much easier to follow and much less demanding than the fences around fences around fences that the Torah Shebichtav, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, adds to the practice. And so the teaching is that we accepted the Torah Shebichtav wholeheartedly, but the Torah Sheba'al Peh through coercion. And yet the halacha is that a contract that's entered into through coercion is not binding. And so the reality is we were not bound to the Torah Sheba'al Peh from until Purim, until hundreds of, a long time after Har Sinai. And so in the Purim story, at the end, it says Kimu v'Kiblu that they Esther and Mordechai established the Chag of Purim from then and forevermore, and that is a like it's an act of Torah Sheba'al Peh where the people themselves, the rabbis themselves, the people themselves created a chag that I mean they found a source for it in the Torah and all that to kind of strengthen the to authorize it, but really it was the like an example of the Torah of the a living example of and of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. That Kimu v'Kiblu means they fulfilled and they received the kind of mitzvah of Purim that to be observed from that point and forevermore. So right. So Esther is really the Esther and Mordechai, but it's called Megillat Esther, that Esther is really the channel for the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and it's the Matan Torah of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and she and like it was actualized through their establishing of Purim, but it was also came down through Esther and through her mastery of the Torah Sheba'al of Ruach HaKodesh that she brought with her in her kind of most challenging moment of finding her way into the Kaddish Kedoshim, and skirting all the resistance and guards. Okay, so let's see, wait a minute. Share screen. Okay. So first of all, does anybody have anything they want to say about that before we carry on? Wow, it's quite a group tonight. Okay. Okay, so this is Stepping Stones to Ruach HaKodesh. I mean, I've talked about this a lot in the days before the book came out, so it might be familiar to people, but it's always good to have a chazara. Okay, so Oh, but the Ruach HaKodesh is coming up. Did I say this? Ruach HaKodesh is coming up because the only way to get through that revolving sword is to cultivate Ruach HaKodesh, to really be able to listen in, to listen out, to see in, to see out, and to kind of identify what is the most good serving, God serving, and spiritually productive option in any given moment. And we have to, I mean, we're gonna have to become truly masters of Ruach HaKodesh in order to get through that sword. So, and it's kind of, this material is organized in a kind of funny way. We're gonna start with the last, the bottom line that determines whether we are on, we are like the extent to which we have access to Ruach HaKodesh. The primary determinant of that is the extent of our rectified, that our properly aimed and rectified will. And so, working backwards, the stepping stones to Ruach HaKodesh are a properly aimed will. That's the bottom line. All the other things I'm going to mention are there to bring us, to enable us to aim our will truly and purely. So starting with a properly aimed will, that's the key. But in order to have a properly aimed will, we have to have a pure heart. Our desire, the heart is our desire nature, and we're not going to be able to kind of aim our will and trust and read the messages of our heart and of that Hashem is conveying to us without a pure heart. But a pure heart requires equanimity, which is a kind of inner access to an inner quiet. And that inner quiet requires an immunity to flattery and insult, because that's what gets the ego puffing up and inflating and deflating and all that, and the grudges and the vengeance and all those kinds of things that that disturb our inner peace. So the equanimity requires immunity to flattery and insult, which requires immunity. Flattery and insult is not going to happen unless we achieve a mastery over our innate tendencies toward narcissism and shame. So we're going to talk about each one of these at more length. Some sip of water. Also, Ilana is on the Chava Rachel is on the chat, so if you have questions, you can also send things through there. Okay, so starting with Ruach HaKodesh requires a properly aimed will, and really that also means. A properly aimed will is really speaking about properly aimed prayer. Like that prayer is a, there is a, is an expression of will. So all of the preliminaries mentioned below are aimed at one thing, to purify our will to such a degree that our whole heart, right ventricle and left, conscious and unconscious, genuinely desires only good, only truth, only to do what we're designed to do. That single-pointed, unadulterated prayer is the arousal from below, the Atarutta Dilatata, that pulls down the Ruach HaKodesh from above, the Atarutta Dila'ila, that guides the choices of each moment and steers us through the flaming sword. was I going to say about that? Can't remember. Nowadays, okay, can't remember. Nowadays, oh, that I might have said this last week, but that the like we tend to in our prayer of request, which properly aimed will is really a request, a state of request. We tend to relate to Hashem in a kind of adversarial posture of we are wanting this, and Hashem doesn't seem so interested in giving it to us. And so, if we can speak pretty enough or persistently enough, or maybe we can convince Hashem to give us this that he is resisting. But the truth is, Hashem design the only thing that Hashem wants from us is to do what we're designed to do, because that's why he made us. And the only thing that's going to make us happy is to do what we're designed to do. So really, we're on the same team. And in some sense, the challenge of prayer is to want to do what we're designed to do, which is the only thing that's going to make us happy, as much as Hashem is wanting exactly that from us. And so it really is a partnership on that front. Okay, and so nowadays we touch this place of rectified will on occasion, but eventually it must become our default. Kabbalah refers to this pure will rising from the depths as Hevlei Degarma, breath of the bones, a term that conjures the essence of a person. Rav Tzadok teaches, Ki hacheshek hu ikar tzurat ha'adam v'chayut shabo, v'hehevel degarmeh hu kolel kol hachashkot shalo, v'noda lo b'machshavto et hashayach le'oto cheshech. Desire, will, translating, desire, will, is what shapes a life and infuses it with vitality. It's kind of the contours of our life. The breath of the bones, I get this. The breath of the bones incorporates the sum total of authentic desires that inhere in the soul and pulls down into the mind via Ruach HaKodesh all that is relevant to those desires. In other words, what we can do down here in order to facilitate and expedite the answer to those prayers, the satisfaction of that or those wills. The more our will aligns with our mission, like a compass that points north no matter how it's tilted, the more our arousal from below will evoke the Ruach HaKodesh to faithfully guide us through the blades of life's spinning, fiery sword. I'm equating will here with prayer. There are many kinds of prayer: praise, thanksgiving, meditation, hidbodedut. Yet it's the prayer of supplication that fulfills the actual mitzvah of prayer, which, according to Sefer Achinuch, entails crying out to Hashem at a time of need. A prayer of request is a statement of will and an admission of lack. The inner work of prayer at this stage is to identify something big or small that we believe to be an expression of our soul's yearning, consistent with our life's purpose and even essential to it. Nature abhors a vacuum. This kind of prayer exerts a powerful suction that pulls down the lights that are exactly configured to fill its request. To narrow the gap between our present state and what we are actually designed to do. That's forward progress. Ruach HaKodesh needs a specific question. This is one of the main distinguishing features between Ruach HaKodesh and prophecy. Ruach HaKodesh needs a specific question, challenge, or goal to grab onto. And in this regard, it's different from prophecy. Prophecy, the personality is absent. It's like as much as possible empty and almost non-existent in order to be able to be available as a channel for the prophetic flow. And whereas with Ruach HaKodesh, it's really, we start that ball rolling and we kind of exert ourselves to try to understand something we don't understand, or to achieve something we want to achieve or accomplish, whatever it is. And it's that exertion that really then pulls down the Ruach HaKodesh that now as a team, Hashem and we are working together to accomplish this good. This good goal. But that properly aligned will requires a pure heart. In other words, a pure desire. Our desire nature has to become refined. We human beings are built in such a way that our heart is unruly. We can't just order it to want this or that. We have to demonstrate that the only thing that will make us happy is to do this or that. And the only this or that will truly make us happy is when it actually aligns with what we're designed to do. And that is the only thing Hashem wants from us, for He designed us to do exactly that. We have to grasp this truth so deeply that it seeps into our heart and gently corrects its desires without coercion. It becomes clear that only doing what we're designed to do can produce the full benefits we're seeking from life and that are guaranteed not to backfire around the bend. The heart, by nature, is more short-sighted than the head. The heart's growing edge is to incorporate more of the right ventricle's big picture values into the mix of factors that drive its desires. Rebecca, your hands raised.
Am I unmuted? Okay. Hi. I thought I heard, I don't like to use the word machloket, but the difference between the Baal Shem Tov and Reb Nachman about whether you should pray for everything or Hashem already knows. Does this sound familiar? Like Hashem already knows, and why are you bringing this up? Does that sound familiar to you?
Well, not really. I never heard that said in the name of the Baal Shem Tov. I mean, Rabbi Nachman is, pray for a shoelace. And the Baal Shem Tov is really like kind of his master of prayer. I mean, he really is urges deep,
right?
Yeah, you're like that. You're a symptom bearer of the Shekhinah. Your will and your lacks are really you have to is you is you're receiving. You've just gotten a message that the Shekhinah is ailing in the way that you are troubled. And so you should pray for the Shekhinah and pray for yourself, basically. And
Thank you.
Pray hard. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so equanimity. Let's see. Okay, but the pure heart, a pure heart, is only accessible, like that requires equanimity. For the problem is, we don't generally know. We're supposed to pray for what we're designed to do, but the reality is, we don't generally know what it is that we're designed to do. There are so many options and so many expectations and so many pressures to conform to this or that. True, every moment is a communication between Hashem and our soul. But how do we find its channel of transmission? How do we distinguish between our ego's messages and our Ruach HaKodesh? Like the ego's messages are kind of intuitions. They sound pretty plausible. The ego's pretty slick with his messages. So they sound pretty plausible, but they're not the message. So how do we distinguish between our ego's message and our Ruach HaKodesh, our Kol Dmama Daka, our still small voice? For says Rav Tzadok, they both communicate through our inner voice, through our still small voice. That discernment is especially complicated since it's set up. I mean, it's a pretty messy setup where the ego makes the call. It gets the message, translates it like into into some kind of concrete form, and then it rules on its authenticity, that decides whether it's really an authentic Ruach HaKodesh or not, and then decides based on that whether to act on it. So the ego, the Ruach, has a lot of power in here too. Like there's a lot of steps and a lot of places for distortion and for twisting. And so a reactive ego stirs up the pot, decide, making it nearly impossible to get a true read on these matters. It's like the difference between a reflection produced on the surface of a still pond versus one that's disturbed by wind and rain. The latter reflection disintegrates into a fragmented hodgepodge of color with no recognizable image to be found. Equanimity is essential to Ruach HaKodesh. Like you can be in a state, you can be triggered, and you have to be able to just put that aside and kind of find the space of inner peace in order to process through. In order to access and process the Ruach HaKodesh and to apply it to the challenge at hand. When our mind is like still water, it's more likely to spot the message of the moment and read it correctly and take its truths to heart. But this equanimity requires an immunity to flatter and insult, because it's the flattery and insult that activate the ego and get it inflating, deflating, etc. So equanimity requires an ego that is ideally impervious to bribes, that is not seduced by glimmers of personal gain or threatened by personal loss. An ego that is only swayed by truth. Otherwise, it can't be trusted. Unconscious motives will cause it to add or subtract metaphoric weight from the relevant factors, causing the scale to tip, not coincidentally, to the side of greatest ego gain. And because this is happening unawares, it's not so simple to root it out. A famous teaching tale by Rav Chaim Vital presents an ideal that for most of us is beyond what's actually achievable, yet its point is to get us aiming in the right direction. A young scholar approached the famous mystery school that trained its students to be prophets and seers. He asked to be initiated into their circle. The tzaddik who interviewed the petitioner praised his intentions. "Blessed are you, child of God. Your goals are great. I have one question for you. Pray, tell me, have you attained equanimity?" The aspirant requested an explanation of terms. The tzaddik replied, "There are two men. One respects you and one insults you. Are they equal in your eyes?" The aspirant responded, No, they are not. I feel good and at peace with the one who respects me, and I am pained by the insult. I would never take revenge or hold a grudge against the latter, for the Torah forbids that. Nevertheless, they do evoke different feelings inside me. The tzaddik replied, "Go in peace, my son, until you have attained equanimity, until you are totally God-referenced. You are not fit to attain prophecy. Until your insides do not respond to flattery or insult, you are not ready to enter the higher states of consciousness that we teach here. Go and work on yourself still more. When your heart attains humility and equanimity, you may return and join our circle." One who seeks divine guidance for life decisions is pursuing a subtle form of prophecy, and the requirement of equanimity equally applies. The ego's vulnerability to flattery and insult is what the Torah calls knowledge of good and evil. In the ego's lexicon, good is all that pleases the ego, and evil is what diminishes it. We need to keep an eye on the ego's attempts to downgrade the significance of factors that cause it discomfort, regardless of their truths, of their truth. The bigger our blind spots in this regard, the more skewed our assessments, and the less reliable our intuitions. The question becomes, how do we get to the bottom of this? How do we embody the Baal Shem Tov's interpretation of the first mitzvah of the code of Jewish law that applies from the moment of awakening to the moment of sleep? Shiviti Hashem l'negdi tamid. That's the primary translation is, I place God before me at all times. But the Baal Shem Tov reads it differently. He reads, whatever life brings, Shiviti, I know that you, Hashem, are equally near. Like shivyon, like to eat, whether it's good, whether it's bad, I know that you, Hashem, are equally near, that Devekut is available in every moment, be it a good moment or a bad moment, ostensibly. So that is the fruit of equanimity, that disengagement from flattery and insult is the fruit of equanimity. If every moment is equally good or equally accessible, if Devekut is equally accessible, then it's equally good, and there is no vulnerability to flattery and insult. But that level of equanimity requires a mastery of narcissism and shame. It's the ego's intolerance to shame that underlies its hypersensitivity to flattery, insult, blame, and slight. It's like a bruise that we completely forget about until something touches it, at which point we flinch and push it away. It's a reflex. We don't think about it. Exactly so, and exactly so is the ego's response to shame. Over time, the ego becomes so expert at deflecting shame that it learns to anticipate threat and steer around it. Sometimes that's for better, but oftentimes it's for worse. What happens if the message of the moment, the truth that Hashem is trying to convey, is one that the ego associates with discomfort? You know, it's always easier to see these things in other people, but it's, you know, it's sometimes it's just so clear that that a person is receiving a message. They talk about it, they receive the message, and they reject it because it's because of the as false because of the ego discomfort that it produces. What happens if the message of the moment, the truth that Hashem is trying to convey, is one that the ego associates with discomfort? In such a case, our ego is likely to sweep it under the rug before our conscious self catches wind of it. When this happens, our interpretation of the situation will be warped, and our response will be ineffectual, perhaps even disastrous, as we'll see. Vulnerability to flattery and affront is a universal liability that arises from the disowned shame permeating the raw materials out of which we're built. Really, no blame. We looked at the seven universes created and destroyed. We're saturated with narcissism and shame. That's our pekala, and that's our contribution to Tikkun Olam, is to work all that through. The ego's refusal to no one is immune to its sway. The ego's refusal to forgive its insults and to face its flaws distorts its worldview and warps its decisions. In the stepwise sequence of creating our universe, Hashem underwent a gradually intensifying series of concealments. The ultimate effacement and lowest layer is idolatry, where Hashem is not just invisible, but his accomplishments are actually ascribed to an other. And the worst form of idolatry is self-worship, as it lacks even the humility of acknowledging a higher power, such as nature, for example. The ego, in its immaturity, believes itself a god and claims the perks of that position, most particularly the power to prosecute insults. The ego is vigilant and swift to punish all that endangers its godlike status. The primitive ego ranks every moment as good or evil, flattering or insulting, gratifying or deflating. That's what's happening at the subliminal base of our psyche. It's curious to note that the most primitive layer of a computer is just zeros and ones. All its sophistication of performance and nuance and artificial intelligence builds upon that binary string. Exactly so is our primitive psyche post-Eden, after imbibing knowledge of good and evil. It too grades every moment as good or evil, belittling or praising, safe or threatening, plus or minus, zero or one. I just want to share a diagram that appeared on my computer a couple days ago. Where'd it go? Wait a minute. Let me share screen. Wait, where did I? Oops. Can you see it? It's like this is there. Look there. These are all zeros and ones. Looking at the computer printout. Anyway, with the telescope backwards. I don't know. I just got a kick out of that. Okay, stop share. Okay, zeros and ones. But that is our primitive, like our primitive ego psyche is back there, just constantly kind of zero, one, zero, one, zero, one. The problem here is not that this is happening. The problem, but wait, but just that zero, one, also its lack of nuance. But the problem here is not that this is happening. The problem is our lack of awareness of it. Without conscious involvement, were unable to correct its defensive, childish, and often erroneous interpretations. And worst of all, its misreadings produce emotions and anxieties that actively impair our ability to recognize the most spiritually productive option in any given moment. Like the Wizard of Oz, the primitive ego is the man behind the curtain, pulling the levers, pressing the buttons, causing the hoopla that diverts our attention from the disowned shame that's recorded in that binary string, and the anxiety, resentment, and fantasies of retaliation it has produced. Hashem clearly set up the world with a growth curve. In our childish, narrow-minded immaturity in our katnut, we are more reactive, defensive, and manipulated by our unconscious avoidance of shame. But over the years, if we pay attention and work on ourselves, our visual field widens and the long-term consequences of our deeds become visible. This, in turn, allows us to make wiser decisions, wiser choices. Concurrently, our ego becomes more tolerant of truths and circumstances that cause it discomfort. So I was thinking that maybe this would be a good week to break into. Malka, did you, are you up for that? Yeah. So maybe this would be a good week to break, because there's a lot of content to talk about, to break into breakout rooms and just yeah.
Okay. So anyone who doesn't wanna, someone needs to go. Anyone who doesn't want to be in the breakout room, we'll see you next week. So I'll know how many breakout rooms to make. And it can be nice to, we have about 10 minutes, 5 minutes each. Sorry, Deep.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah.
Okay, so about 5 minutes each, and it's nice to give kind of one person to share and reflect and kind of time to go inside and before the discussion, kind of give someone space to, but you do it your way, whatever feels right. And oh, I'm not a co-host. Sorry, Deep.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
I mean, the truth is, there aren't so many people. We could just have a discussion right here with everyone. What do you think?
Sure.
I mean, I guess it's hard because then we can't regulate it, like 5 minutes for, like the timing of
We
it.
could do 12 minutes, seven. We could do 2 minutes each. Do people want to do that? And not required.
So many people are not showing up. Is it because they're not here or because they're just blocking their screen? Because there's a lot of
Well, how about
people.
raise hands? People that want to share can raise hands and we'll see. Yeah. I'm going to jump in because I had something I wanted to and I'll keep an eye on the time. It's the emotions, if I understood correctly, Ruach is kind of sandwiched in between Nefesh Chiyunit and Nefesh Elokit.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah.
Correct? Yeah. Okay. So it seems to me like it's the kind of juice that allows for the energy to flow between them, for the information to pass like a battery to pass between them. And in the Prayer and Destiny Chabura, which I wanted to just say to everybody, there's so much of this content to really get your feet dirty and hands in it, and your whole soul in it is Sarit's Prayer and Destiny course, this whole chashmal and prayer and will piece. So in our Chabura, Lev HaChaya said something of that. You know, you say the electrum, chashmal is the electrum. And so also in order for that energy, that charge to move through, we need the chash and we need the mal. We can't get stuck in one or the other. If we leave out the chash, so the like the energy, like the electrum, the light, the energy can't happen. And so the same with the emotions are such an important resource for us of touching into, allowing our emotions to touch into kind of the raw, they're in our viscera, to kind of touch in and feel it in our nefesh be'emit, like in the pain and discomfort of that. But that's what allows for then us to get to the nefesh Elokit. That's the charge, like a battery, the charge to for the that and for that Ruach HaKodesh to happen, the chashmal of Esther Malkah.
I mean, that's the Baal Shem Tov has a kind of quite controversial teaching where he says better that a person should be vulnerable to ta'avot, like struggle there, but than to not, because that kind of struggle is the heat that is transformed into dvekut, and that are the drive for dvekut. And so,
You hit right, the to keep it moving, to allow for it to, so that it comes back up.
Shandell,
Okay.
you have a finger up. I mean, you have a hand up.
Thank you. Hi. First of all, I want to thank you for this. It's really seeping in. As you said, just let it seep in. So I had a real life
Seep in.
opportunity to use it where my daughter, who's an adult with three children, I was over at her house and sharing something, and then we had a like a kind of a resistance in the sharing. And then later she called me a few days later and she said, I asked AI, she goes, I was really triggered by something you were doing. And I asked AI, because she has a bachelor in psychology. She described to AI what I was doing, and I defined it as splitting, which is literally what you were talking about today, where splitting is like good or bad. Like, this is the best doctor, and he does one thing wrong, and now he's the worst doctor. And so she was describing it to me, and she said, it was incredible, Geula work. So she said, so as I'm hearing her say this, I'm hearing my ego just freak out, like, of course you're dumping this on me, the whole thing. But because of this work, I just listened and let it wash over inside. I really listened. And then she said, and so I looked inside myself to see where I was doing this, because she said, I'm your daughter, right? So you were doing this when I was growing up. So now I looked inside, and I was like, and then over Shabbos, I was just replaying the whole conversation, and I'm getting the chills because it's like, this is the real work now. It's like, it was, and then of course I was doing it too. I was like, oh wow, she just defined something to me that was elusive and that I was doing. And so now I can look at it as well. And
Wow,
really
beautiful.
amazing. And I said, thank you for letting me be your whatever, like your opportunity for like ego reduction. I mean, I didn't say it that way, but it was like, I'm so glad. I said, I'm so glad I could help. Like, it's like it used to be this didn't help us. We used to like be in major combat.
Wow. Wonderful,
Yeah.
wonderful,
Thank God.
wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so
Yeah.
much.
And Yehudi, you wanted to share something, did you? You're muted. You're muted.
There. I've been with Malkasima. We've been together for about a year and a half now with this extraordinary group. I mean, it's just evolved and it's beautiful. And you know, we went from Prayer and Destiny into the Kabbalah of Shame, and it's somehow everything, you know, everything that's going on in my life, or what the things that come to the forefront, I guess it's the things that I need to address. This just feeds into it. The teaching, I mean, today, you know, even there was one point where you were speaking about the oh gosh, the well, I guess it's this mote, it's the Klipa Noga, and it was right before you got to exactly the point that I was going to, you know, that I had this burning question inside, you know, because it's like I can't get to it. You know, it's this process, and it's and there's so much there to pick and choose from about, and you know, to do it in the moment. I haven't encountered one of those situations right now that seems that important to me, but there's something that's evolving, that's been evolving over the last couple of months with an adult child. And I've been holding back from responding to a very poignant text that brought up, you know, brought up like his whole childhood to me, and everything that I'd, you know, and every way, every which way that I could have done something better or different, that of course I couldn't at the time, you know, this is like 40 years later, but just trying to figure out how to navigate this, because it's, you know, it's a very important relationship, and it entails a grown granddaughter as well. So, you know, there's just and it brought up a lot of shame. You know, it just all kind of came up. And so I'm just glad to be here. I mean, I don't know that I'm asking for an answer, but you know, just to kind of vent a little bit, and say, you know, I feel like I'm in the
Journal,
very
yeah.
I'm in the right place.
Right. Sometimes journaling helps too, I find
I
for
do
myself.
journal. I do journal. I've almost been afraid to journal this because I'm afraid of how much, and I journal a lot. But this is kind of yeah, this is kind of real. This is down to the depths.
Meaning the consequences of one false move type thing, one wrong move.
Just encountering things that I might encounter, and then not knowing how to climb my way back up again. You know, as far as the journaling, and yeah, it's very sensitive. It feels like a very sensitive issue, and I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to miscalculate.
Well, blessings that you should find the clarity inside, outside the clarity to
Thank you.
navigate the situation in a way that is good serving, God serving, and spiritually growing.
Thank you.
Okay. Shavua Tov.
Thank you. What the
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.